Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should have to come, should any of you seem to have failed to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them, but the message they heard did not benefit them, because they were not united by faith with those who listened. For we who have believed enter that rest as he said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this passage he said, they shall not enter my rest. Since, therefore, it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news fail to enter because of disobedience, again he appoints a certain day, today, saying, though through David, so long afterward, in the words already quoted, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience. For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and spirit, of joints and marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And no creature is so hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession.
All right, we'll pause there. Sorry. Perfect. No, that's perfect. Because that's that unit. And it's really interesting to me that this whole thing starts out back in chapter 3 and verse 1. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus. And then he says, consider Jesus these two things. He says he's the apostle and he's the high priest. Then we get all of this information and we don't go into the high priest part at all. So it's sort of like he's setting up two things, and he concludes there, or we conclude there in chapter 4, verse 14, where he says, now let's go to the high priest thing. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. So, heads up, the whole high priest stuff is coming. He's going to go into that. But really, I think what he then goes through here is more about maybe this apostle piece, this servant, this one sent to do something. And his way of doing that is to say, you Hebrews, you Hebrew Christians who are interested in trying to get a little bit of the Old Testament, the old law, the old Hebrew way of life melded into your Christianity, do you really want to go there? Because if you really want to go there, I'm going to go there with you and I'm going to remind you of some things. I'm going to remind you of what it was like for your people to initially leave Egypt, and let's cover a little bit of their history. Let's cover a little bit of their experience. Because this whole thing of going back to the old law, going back to the old ways, and going back to a way of sort of orienting salvation and having it be the old law, and in essence, you're rejecting Christ when you do that. And I want to remind you of your history. I want to take you back to where your people went and remind you of what a disaster that actually was. And so then he spends some time here. He uses, I think, this one cent, this servant idea in the house to conjure up Moses. And he says, let's talk about Moses. And he compares Jesus to Moses and uses that as an entry into what Moses did in his history, which was to be the one who led them out of slavery and into the promised land. And he says, don't just think about going into the promised land and how great that was. There was a mess for 40 years of getting there. And so we talked just a little bit about on Wednesday kind of what happened and how they left Egypt and how they worked their way pretty early on down to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. And there was this incident that is partly being brought up and partly being utilized by going to the 95th Psalm, where King David, around 1,000, writes this psalm and goes back and talks about this history. And he says, hey, great, the Hebrew writer says, great psalm for us to use to remind you of this big mess. Today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as in the rebellion on the day of testing in the wilderness. We talked a little bit about how the word rebellion there is meribah, and the day of testing is masah. And those were two specific things that very early on, when Moses wound up over here at Mount Horeb and the people were thirsty, that God gave them water, but it illustrated how they rebelled, and it illustrated how they were testing him already in the wilderness. And this was very early on in this leaving Egypt. And so already, very early on, there's a problem with these people. As they've left an awful situation and are headed to something really good, they're already wanting to go back. And so that idea of going back, I think he's getting these Hebrew Christians to say, you really want to go back, you got to go back and remember these people wanting to go back and what a mess that was. So we talked about that a little bit on Wednesday and talked about this reference to this 95th Psalm. But he's got more to say about that. And he jumps into that starting in verse 12, and he takes that through the end of chapter 3. And he goes into this conversation, this explanation, this warning to these people, and it involves unbelief. He talks about unbelief, and he talks about being deceived by sin, and he talks about disobedience, and he talks about hard-heartedness, and he talks about falling away. So what I want you to do is just look at chapter 3, 12 through 19. And I want you to think about and try and be able to explain the relationship between these concepts and these terms of unbelief and being deceived by sin and disobedience and hard-heartedness and falling away, because he seems to keep trying to explain all of this to them and use this history and use these experiences and use what they know about the gospel to try and get them to think about this. And it's interesting the way it's written. It's interesting the way it's structured. It moves around and it bounces around. There's a lot of connecting to all of these different thoughts. And I think we've got to be able to explain how all of this works as Christians. And I think we've got to be able to understand what he's saying here. So my question to you is, what's the relationship between all of these things? What's the point he's trying to drive home in chapter 3, 12 through 19? Rich.
Well, I think our assumption, and probably theirs too, is that this rebellion and the 40 years and all that was somehow part of God's plan, and he wanted things to go down this way. And I think what he's trying to point out is they deserved it. This generation of people did the wrong thing. They didn't believe, they were deceived, they were hardened in their hearts, and they rebelled. And so it didn't have to happen, right? They didn't have to not enter the rest. And I think the lesson for these Christians that are reading this is just being in a relationship with God, being God's people, does not mean you get to heaven. You actually have to be obedient still. They were in a relationship. I mean, they got the Ten Commandments themselves. They saw this happen, and yet they didn't obey, and so they didn't enter. So just because we are Christians doesn't mean that we automatically are going to heaven. We've got to still obey.
Okay, there's some responsibility there on the Christian. There's some responsibility there on the follower. We've got some things we have to do. And it's interesting. I mean, he kind of summarizes it with it's all about belief versus unbelief, and yet that's a big concept, like what it means to believe. You can't just say you believe without having to actually act on that belief in some way, shape, or form. We don't get to just remain stagnant in all of this. Jeff?
I think in the case of both the Israelites in the wilderness and these first century Jewish Christians, and you can make the connection to Christians today as well, not the people in this room of what I'm about to say, but I think in the case of those two groups, those two classes of people, they no one would say they didn't believe in God. When you're talking about unbelief, it wasn't that they didn't believe that God was real, that God existed, that God helped bring them out of Egypt, or that God was responsible for the law. I don't think we would say that's where their head was at. But I think what we might say is they didn't trust in God. Yeah, they believed in Him, but they didn't trust in Him. Yes, they believed in God and that God was powerful, but they weren't confident that God was gonna deliver them truly that he was going, that he was going to get them out of the wilderness, that he was going to bring them into the land of Canaan. These, the Israelite or the Hebrews in the first century, they had trust issues as well. They had confidence issues as well. They had lack of confidence in the new covenant that Jesus brought in and in the new law, that that was the path to salvation, and that that lack of confidence, that unbelief in that particular instance led to, hardness of heart. And instead of trusting in God and staying the course and being steadfast, you know, words that we read about, they drifted back to what they knew, to what they were comfortable with, to what, you know, to what they wanted to do, and that resulted in that hardness of heart, and that allowed them to be susceptible to the deceptiveness of sin, and ultimately that had them drift away from God, fall away from God. And the result for the Israelites in the wilderness was that they didn't get their reward. They didn't get to enter into the new land. And the parallel here for these, the admonishment for these Hebrew Christians is that the same thing is going to happen to you. You're in danger of falling into the same trap. And actually, it's much more perilous for you if we're talking about it in spiritual terms. You're not going to enter into heaven. You're gonna fall away from the Lord, and you're gonna go to hell. So that's how I sort of see the relationship between all those things up there.
Very, very good. Very good. Angie.
And just as I was bringing out on Wednesday night too, that we talked about this a little bit, that it's evil. The word evil is used. It's not just, oh, unbelief, deceived by sin. Mm-hmm. It's evil. And like Jeff said, it's going to cost you your soul. That's what he's trying to get these people to see and to realize, and us to see and to realize. It's not just not getting to go into the promised land. It's forever at this point. And it's, it, you know, while we still have the time, don't lose your confidence in this, because it's an evil thing to do.
Right. He talks a lot in this whole section. He really gives, I think, some clues. It's not even clues. I mean, he's pretty direct about belief. Like, what is it we're really supposed to believe? It's not just believing that God exists. It's interesting when you go back and you look at these people in this time period with Moses, it doesn't ever sound like they said, I'm starting to really think there isn't a God. I'm starting to believe there isn't a God. They were almost like, there's something about what God has said we don't believe. They were supposed to believe in a promise. They were supposed to believe that God would deliver on his word. And so God doesn't just immediately press buttons and move people from Egypt into the promised land and it's over. There was sort of there's going to be a promised land, and I'm going to take you there, and we're going to get you there, and you're going to have it. However, we're going to have to go through we're going to have to get there. And when we get there, we're going to have to do something, and I'm going to need you to engage with the people that are there. We know they get up to this moment at Kadesh Barnea with these spies, and the spies go in and they say, it's all there like God said it was there. He promised it was going to be a great place. It's a great place. But 10 of them say, there's an issue. I don't think we can beat the people that are there. Obviously, two of them, and Caleb and Joshua, say, what does it matter? God said we could do this. We just got to go and do it. So it's more than just believing there's a God. There's something here about believing in what he has said he will do. It's believing in his promises, that he's true to his word. And he doesn't give us those things right away. There's some time that has to occur. There's some things we have to do. There's a life we have to live. There's some experiences we've got to go through where we keep saying, ooh, it's getting difficult, but I'm going to go ahead and do the Joshua thing. I'm going to go ahead and do the Caleb thing. I think we can accomplish this because God said we could accomplish this. So belief in the promises is real critical. Heather, and then Jim, and then Scott, and no Heather now. So we go to Jim, and then we'll come back over to Scott.
So the scriptures are clear. In fact, he's going to tell us in Hebrews that he disciplines his children. And he tested them in the Old Testament. He made that very clear. I'm going to test you. James tells us that he does not tempt us, however. But he allows tests and perhaps even sends tests to discipline his children. When does it become a temptation? It becomes a temptation when we decide that we're going to turn his test into a temptation. We decide to give in to ourselves. But a test is actually a test of our faith in him. And I also just want to make a note about verse 13. But encourage one another daily, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. That's why he's going to tell us in chapter 10 that he wants us to continue to assemble together. That's why he puts us together, so that we can encourage one another and help prevent us from being hardened by sin's deceitfulness.
Yeah. Look how many times in here he calls them brothers. There's a reason for that. There's a reason we're identified as a family. There's a reason we're identified as brothers, because we're supposed to work together like a family does. He's already made it clear in chapter 3 early on, we are the house. We're the house. There's never like a just purely individual on your own component of this. Even the people in the wilderness, we're talking about probably a million people roaming around out there that were supposed to work together. It's always been along the way. Some he mentions in here sharing, right? We share in Christ together. We talk about fellowship all the time. The emphasis on us helping each other do this cannot be lost in this passage. It's kind of what one of the suggestions the writer gives us to prevent falling away is, you got to exhort one another. You got to help one another in this process. You got to remind one another. There's a respect that along the way it gets difficult. There's a respect for at times you're kind of tired, you're thirsty, you're hungry. There's a respect and understanding that that would be going on in the wilderness, but they were supposed to do what Joshua and Caleb did, which was exhort everybody, hey, back to God. Don't forget what he told us. Don't forget what he promised us. He's going to deliver. He's going to deliver. Scott and then Thomas.
So I'm struck here by two verses. 3:19 says that they were unable to enter because of disbelief. 4:6 says they failed to enter because of disobedience. Disbelief and disobedience are equivalent, you know, since James and before, right? Christians have wanted to argue about faith and works. I think this scripture tells you can't meaningfully separate faith and works. What you do is what you really believe.
Yeah.
What you believe is what you will do. It's the same thing.
It's really good, Scott. That's why I said I think there's a relationship between all these terms and all these concepts, because you can't just isolate one piece out of it and say, just believe in God, like Rich said. We believe. Okay, we're good. Now there's nothing else to do. We just kind of hang out and wait until the time comes. No, there's some expectation. There's some things to obey. That's what obedience is. There's some expectations we're going to do some stuff. We got to go do it. We're not perfect with that. We make mistakes with that. We got to help one another with that. But we're supposed to keep moving. We're supposed to always come back to the promise, always come back to what God has guaranteed and believe that it's going to happen. That's why I obey. So that's why I'm trying to get to. I really think this is an interesting passage on relationships between all of these different kind of theological and Christian concepts, right? That we've got to keep connected in our mind, that there's a process here. It's not just a one-time thing. And the big summary of it is, so we see that they were unable to enter because of belief. Well, he's just given some huge explanation of what belief and unbelief is, and it's all wrapped up in there. Thomas.
I think one of the key things in this passage that for me to understand is the deceitfulness part of it. And I keep thinking, well, what is this deceit? What is this? Why are they sinning? Why are they led to sin? And I think it's pretty simple. And the deceit is that their way, in their own mind, was better than God's way. It's kind of what's being mentioned, is that God doesn't do things right away, but yet we want things to happen on a much shorter timeline often. And I think there's a good reminder there in verse 14 where it says, "For we have come to share in Christ, if indeed we hold our original confidence firm to the end." And I think, why does he mention that? What is this original confidence? And I think, if we think about applying this to us today, when we were first baptized, when we made that commitment, I don't think anyone was thinking, oh, I'm going to follow my own plan, right? No, when you're in that moment and you make that decision about the confidence you have, I believe, is, if you're doing it for the right reasons, is 100% in God's plan. And so I think that's just a nice
reminder for us to think back, what was our original confidence? What did we believe when we were first, when we did first believe? And it was that our way is not going to work. It's God's way that will work.
Right. I was struck. I'm sure I've read this before, and I did not write down where in Numbers this is, but it's over in Numbers, and someone else in here will probably know. I was trying to think about this Exodus through the Red Sea, and then they get up here to Kadesh Barnea, and by timeline, that's probably about 18 months that they're leaving Egypt, and at the moment of, let's go, it's time to go into the Promised Land. It's about 18 months. And over in Numbers, it records somewhere. Because I thought, yeah, there's a couple times in here where they kind of show that they're giving up. They kind of show that they're rebelling. They kind of show that they're losing their faith. Over in Numbers, God said 10 times from the moment we've left to here, you've complained, you've grumbled, you've quit. You've said, we want to go back. You've said, this isn't working. 10 times you've demonstrated you don't believe that I'm going to do what I said I'm going to do. So it's a lot that's going on just in that 18 months after, for lack of a better term, them sort of being converted, right? As a nation coming out of Egypt, plagues, Red Sea, wow, God's on our side and it's time and Pharaoh's letting us go. Just in an 18-month period after that amazing experience, 10 times they're buckling and just saying they're being deceived by sin. They're being deceived by what they really want. They're being deceived by we miss the food we had. Did we not have meat in the pot back in Egypt? It was better than this. They keep saying that over and over again. And as Rich points out, they could have just been strong all the way through and gone right in, and we would have been on our way with what God promised. But instead, they had to go through this 40-year time period of resetting these expectations till they could get their mind right with a new generation and they could go in. And so it didn't have to be that way, but it illustrates, like Thomas says, there's a human weakness that we have to be very careful of, that once we commit, we still start to have to deal with the world, and there's going to be things that are going to undermine our faith, and there's going to be things that are going to make us start to question, and there's some important practical things I think we got to do to address that, to stay strong, and to actually be able to get all the way to this promised land and this rest. Ben.
And what's interesting is that's the evil. You know, growing up, I'm thinking the evil is this dark figure, shadowy figure that was sneaking off the Israelites out of their tents and brainwashing them, sticking them back in there. And that's not what it is. The evil is the deceit. It's the lie that it's okay, which really applies to us. And it's easy, kind of like what's been talked about, it's easy to pick on them. But think about it. That's like we talk about our kids going to Bible camp for a week. These guys were at Bible camp for all this time, right? They were out camping in the wilderness, living it. Everything's being provided for them.
No snack shack.
Yeah. No snack shack. It was no showers. No showering.
They still let that deceit, that lie. And it's interesting, after going through the Revelations class, it's like that's really what the evil is. And you don't know what evil is unless you know what truth is, right? So you have to study the truth to be able to know then what evil is. And every example from the Israelites all the way through to today, when people fall away or a hardness of hearts because they lose sight of the truth, they let that lie turn their hearts. Yeah. These aren't like really bad tattooed adulterous alcoholics roaming around, right? These are rabbis that were all dressed up. Like, it looked like they were supposed to be doing what they were supposed to be doing, but that lie had attacked them too, you know?
The tattoos?
Yeah. Sorry. No picking on tattoos, sorry. But you know what I mean? It's just that visual picture that we grew up with.
No.
Are you here, Teresa?
What? Decaf. Sorry.
Decaf. Heather and I were. Heather, I totally get it. Heather and I were in a conversation yesterday in the backyard that was just talking about life and stuff, not necessarily this. And at one point, she had to like, hey, I'm right here. She has to do that all the time because I get like bent. I get that way when I get excited about something or fired up about something.
That's a pop culture there.
This. This deceitfulness of sin is really interesting to me, and how we can be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. And that's actually in the 95th Psalm that David writes about in explaining to these people. Today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as in the rebellion. That heart hardening thing's always been interesting to me. And I think it's really important, because I think there's something happening here. Again, I think everyone goes through challenging moments. I think everybody sins and makes mistakes. It's how we respond to those things that's very important. But when we kind of start to, in our own mind, think we know more than God, when we start to think, I'm going to take control of the situation and I'm going to do that, it's a bit of what we talked about with Moses on Wednesday night, where at some point he kind of like loses it a little bit and tries to take it all into his own hands, and he pays a price for that. I think there's a point with the deceitfulness of sin thing that we start to let it deceive us into different thinking. And when we start to let it deceive us into different thinking, that's when our heart is going the wrong way. It's starting to harden, and it's really hard to get that back. Hebrews is going to mention that a couple times here later. Some really challenging passages about people who get a hard heart and fall away from this. There's no other way to bring them. There's no other back door to get back in. There's only one way to salvation. And that hard-hearted thing, I think, is a big part of the warning. Not that you would ever sin and make a mistake. That's different. When you start to kind of give up on God, when you start to give up on Christ, when you start to give up on the plan that he's put before you and the one way to get to that rest, that's when your heart's going to start to harden and you're in a dangerous situation. And I think he's really hitting that with these Hebrews. Allison, then Jim, then Rich.
Kind of piggybacking on Jim's comment earlier, I do think it's interesting how the concept of us being together is a key part. It's like it is the thing that's mentioned as the way to battle this. So if we're not together, then we're missing out on the primary way to battle this deceitfulness of
Absolutely.
Sin. So, and it says, exhort one another every day, and, you know, whatever. It doesn't say, get exhorted every day. You know, it's like we're supposed to be looking
right.
for ways to do
right.
it,
right.
and then not twice a week. You know, every day, and then you have to ask yourself, what am I doing to exhort other people, and at a minimum, am I showing up, and then what other things am I doing, and it's...
Yeah, you're hitting this question, what suggestions does the writer give us to prevent all of this? So certainly think about that and those. And if you got a comment on that, I want to try to get to some of that, because I want to talk about how we deal with this, but... Jim had a comment, and then back to Rich. That's maybe still on this.
About this deceitfulness, one of my favorite passages is in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 28. Where can we go? Our brothers have made us lose heart. They say the people are stronger and taller than we are. That was true. The cities are large with walls up to the sky. We even saw the Anakites there. Then I said to you, do not be terrified, do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God who is going before you will fight for you. It looks like life sometimes is the walls that we have to traverse in life are too tall for us to get over. They go up to the sky. If there's division in our church, if there is trouble in our marriage, if there is a loss of job, if there is disappointment in life, whatever about this life that Satan wants us to focus on ourselves as victims, in spite of the fact that God has actually brought us into Zion, which he's going to make that point later in the book, we're actually in Zion with the angels. We're in there now. But Satan wants us to look at the problems in this life and say, God hasn't taken enough care of you. And the response is, I will get you through this. I will bring you home.
Right. Very good. Rich.
So the hard heart and all this, I think it's hard for us to be, and we know about heart disease and cholesterol and stuff. But hard heart for them, I think, means, in the context, going all the way back to verse 1 of chapter 1, not listening, right? That sin, if we listen to what we want to hear instead of believing promises that eventually we get to where we can sit on a pew, we can hear David preach every Sunday, but we're not hearing it anymore. We're not listening. And that's why from the start of this letter or sermon, he's been saying, God spoke to you, or to our fathers, and now he's speaking to you, and you got to listen. And he keeps saying that those who heard are the ones who rebelled, right? These people, they weren't listening, and we have got to keep listening. And so I think that's the connection. It's the ear and the heart.
Yeah, very good. All right, okay, Angie.
Well, I was just going to say that he says that three times. He quotes that passage three times. And I think it's interesting that he says today, if you hear, and that's, I think, what Rich is getting at. We all can hear it. He knew they heard it. He said, if you hear, that means if you listen, if you take it in, if you understand it. If, that's not really, I think that's an interesting word. I don't know if it's really what it is in the original, but it's like when you hear it, or since you heard it.
Right.
Not just if, because right. We all heard it.
Right, and these would all be people who heard it. It's really what they're doing with what they heard.
Listen. So, to get to your question, I think he starts out by telling them to consider Jesus, which is going back to the source, tells them to hold fast or hold firm three times. Tells us to take care. He tells us to exhort one another. He tells us to fear the Lord, to listen, which is being brought up, to strive. And then he finishes that with hold fast again. So these are all, we have to be active in all of these things. And even that idea of holding fast and holding firm, it's come up a lot in conversations lately about our faith. Sometimes you've got to just stay. You've got to be still. You need to know it's God is working and you're going to get through this. So it's not always going out and doing something like running. Sometimes you have to be still and know. And just a good reminder. So I think that all of those things are very much things that help us to avoid falling away.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Luke?
Can I share one thing, though, that's... I agree with the end result of what we're all coming up with. That this is an encouragement against backsliding and making sure that we are listening, that we are making choices in our belief, that we are standing, that we are taking action in looking to God and grasping hold of that. But I do find it difficult when we talk about like the falling away concept, because I've dealt with a number of people in family and friends who believe in predestination, believe in, you know, irresistible grace and the election, and you cannot fall away and whatnot. And if I were reading through one of their lenses on something like this, I'd say, look at the example he used. They made a mistake, but he condemned that entire generation. Not a single one of them, their entire bodies fell in the wilderness during a 40-year period of time, regardless of anything else they did from that point forward. And I'm not myself troubled by that, but I could see that lens on this set of scriptures leading to them saying, well, look, here's a section where he says he was provoked for 40 years, regardless. You know, here's a section where he said he swore they're not going to enter his rest. Like, how is that not language that speaks to this idea that either you are or are not, and that there isn't, internally, you can't make a difference in your end destination. You either are elected or you're not.
Okay.
You know, and maybe looking at that, like, lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart. Not become, not gain, not grow. I don't know. It's just, I don't mean to throw any monkey wrench in the conversation. It's just something that, as I read this and I say, yes, I'm nodding my head up and down, going, yeah, I agree with all of this. Then how do you talk to somebody else who maybe isn't as convinced about that idea?
Okay, good question. How would you address that? How would you deal with that? Dave and then Rich.
The most obvious point here is that these people rebel and they continue to rebel, but this isn't talking about eternal life, it's talking about entering into the Lamb. So there were individuals who could have died in the wilderness and still gone to heaven.
Okay. Rich?
I say verses 16 and 17 of chapter 3. They heard and rebelled. That's not a predestination thing. They made a choice. And verse 17, he was provoked because they sinned. Predestination. They chose to disobey. And you can choose to disobey too, or not.
Yeah, it would appear to me, and again, we're talking about a large swath of people, I think it's good to consider that God didn't hold, I guess it'd be everyone 19 and under, accountable for the decisions made by the adults in the room, right? But it would appear that collectively, as a group, all of these people, 20 and older, are of like-minded belief or lack of belief in God's promises. It would appear to me like no one has the courage, other than the few that are mentioned, to raise their hand and say, wait a minute, this is crazy. We should trust in what we've heard. We should trust in the promises. We should trust in the God who's delivered us to this point. Let's go and do this. And that somehow, some way, somewhere, God's able to assess the hearts of these people and say, you have no belief right now as we sit here at Kadesh Barnea. Practically none of you believe that we can go and do what we've said we're going to do. And that's shocking to me, God saying, because of everything I've done for you for 18 months leading up to this and beyond. I think he's saying they're rebelling as collectively, as a group, and individually, each and every one of those people in there. I think he would have said, except for the following, and given us a long list of 40 people or 400 people, if there had been 40 or 400. But there's Joshua and Caleb, clearly. And I mean, I think there's an implication there that Moses at that time, right? I think is believing. And I think there's an implication that Aaron's believing. I don't know that, it's exclusively, of those spies, it's Joshua and Caleb. But as they come and give the report, everybody's sort of giving thumbs up or thumbs down to the report. And everybody, I think, is in their heart choosing a side on that. And I think God's stunned that so many people have chosen that wrong thing. That's what I think is going on there. To Dave's point, and I guess and we'll get into Wednesday, there's a whole thing here about, what's happening here is just a type of a bigger issue that I'm trying to explain about something way more important than a swath of land in the Middle East. That there's something bigger from the beginning that God established for everyone to be able to demonstrate their faith towards. And we don't know exactly if all of the people whose carcasses fell in the wilderness also didn't make it to heaven. That might be a different thing. There might be some people through this experience, boy, they really believed. I mean, they got to the place where they believed in God. They still weren't going to enter the promised land, but heaven does not mean that's crossed off to them. I think we've got to realize that. There's some people who probably were sobered up by this experience and changed their perspective on it. We know even Moses got to that point, and Moses doesn't get to go in the promised land, but I don't think that's an abject failure of Moses's life and faith and inability to get to heaven.
Actually, I like you bringing it back around to Moses, because he's just in this earlier passage described as faithful in God's house in all things.
Yeah.
Yet also did not get to go into the promised land, the difference between the punishment of not going into the promised land and salvation or the ability to go to heaven.
Right.
Might not be a good analogous.
Right.
Thank you.
I'll just say that anybody that's been in the military knows what's going on here, and that's the whole, everybody pays for the sins of some. Now, it might have been most, but that's the way they did things, and it's kind of part of this is just an example. I mean, any individual could have said, we could rebel against the rebellion, but God wasn't pointing out and saying, okay, you get to go, you don't, and that wasn't the point. The point was, he's setting the table for some things that are going to happen later.
I'm laughing because I'm also thinking, anyone who's ever been in a high school class knows this concept. We're on a team. Okay, everybody's going to run. All right, that's it. Everybody gets homework tonight. All right. I'm using this because it took me like 45 minutes to get all of these arrows to line up on a PowerPoint. We're using this. I don't care if the bell rings. I went through like 7 sketches of trying to deconstruct this relationship piece and came up with this. And I think you guys got a lot of these pieces, like Rich and Angie mentioned. Hearing his voice is the critical concept here. You hear his voice and you have confidence in his voice. So you're clear on what your mission is. You're not deceived by sin. You know exactly what you're going to do. You're going to obey. Like Scott said, you're going to follow through with what God needs you to do. And it's going to keep your heart soft as you do that. There's a humbling effect to that. There's a sensitivity to God's word and to your relationship with him. There's sharing in Christ that happens, and it concludes with the rest. And I think that's being contrasted with hearing his voice. Don't forget, these people heard his voice in 1000 BC, and they're in the promised land at the height of their glory. There's people hearing the voice and people not hearing the voice. There's Hebrews in 60 AD that have heard the voice and are not believing in it. And there's 2018, there's Christians that hear his voice, but they don't believe. And that leads to being deceived by sin. And that leads to disobedience. And that's going to lead to a hardened heart eventually. And that's going to lead to a falling away. And that's obviously going to conclude with no rest. And then here's my big finish. It's Alice's point. Bam! I had that thing and figured out how to do that. So he says, like, you've got to exhort one another to hear the voice and exhort one another to have confidence. And I think that's why this is so important, what we're doing here today and Wednesday, but not just those 2 days. All the time, we've got to help each other out with this process.
Can you email that beautiful chart?
I don't know. That's copyrighted. This is like a lot to do this, man. Don't be taking pictures of it, posting it on your Instagrams and whatever. All right.
All right.
I think we got a little more to do here in chapter 4. We'll probably move into chapter 4 on Wednesday. So keep looking at chapter 4, and then we'll be able to finish this unit out. Good job. Thank you. That actually was good. That was really, really, really good.
Okay.